Hello, thank you all for coming and braving the rain. I'm going to assume you can all hear me at the back because I have a microphone. Usually I just use my big booming voice to get up there, but today we're recording the question sessions, and so we're using the mics throughout the entire event, which means that if at the end you're asking a question and you don't have a mic, no one will hear you in the recording, and I will get very grumpy now. So I'm going to remind everyone of that at the question session, but if you all keep that in mind. Also, if you have a phone on you, I believe they turn off. So if you could either put it on silent, if you're so important that you desperately need to have it on, or turn it off, that'd be great. But I'm really pleased to welcome you all here today for the first lecture of the 2020 research program being held here at London. We had one last night at the Royal Aeronautical Society, held by Andy Curtis on translating strategy into military capability. And we have three other lectures at the Royal Aeronautical Society this year that are all in the program. We also have lectures in the Midlands at Wolverhampton University and at our site in Cosford. And for the first time this year, we're going to have lectures at Lancaster University. But for those of you who are London-based, the London Museum has 10 lectures this year. So a plethora of options to get into, including a Battle of Britain programme, which has a lot of contributions from the museum staff. And one of those people is talking today as well, which is Ian Fersk. We're also delighted to have Phil Marter with us from Winchester University, and Loz Atkinson, who's an artist who's brought a number of objects and has done in-situ displays at aviation crash sites. And that's what we're here to discuss. What is the use that we can make of aviation crash sites? What is their utility in today's society? They have a heritage role. We can use them in archaeology. We can use them in art, as we've seen, and in research to understand aviation itself. So I'm delighted to introduce first Phil Marter, who's going to introduce some of the work he's done from an archaeological perspective.
Okay, so I'm an archaeologist. One of my jobs is to investigate the past, but also I feel it's to tell stories about the past. Hopefully they're factually correct ones, of course. And one of the ways I do this is to ensure that I record the things that I'm investigating. It's important because then obviously you can check the validity of the things that I'm telling you about, but also this stuff can be reinterpreted at a later date. And of course, once I've stopped telling the story, other people can tell the story in future. So it's with that in mind that I want to share with you some work that I've been doing to think about sort of crash sites and some of the issues surrounding them. So Historic England estimate that there are considerably in excess of 10,000 military aviation crash sites in the UK. More than 10,000. Nobody actually knows exactly how many. That's an awful lot, isn't it? Admittedly, quite a lot of them being dug up at various times and explored in the past, but of course many more exist across Europe. Each of these has a unique story, and hopefully that will come across from some of the things that we're talking about together today. First of all, I just want to talk about this particular aircraft, 115 Squadron Lancaster DS-793. You'll notice straight away it's a slightly unusual aircraft, and that's one of the sort of 300 that were made with radial engines rather than the Merlin. So it looks a bit odd at first glance. This aircraft actually took off from the beautifully named Little Snoring on an operation to bomb Berlin and was shot down. It was due to return to its new base at RAF Wychford, and some of the stories that arise from this particular operation are quite interesting. There is a story slash legend that crew members on this operation took with them their most prized possessions on the aircraft because they didn't trust the ground crews to move them to the new base. And so the story goes that some of them took their bikes, and there were jokes arising that if one of them came down with the bikes on board, the Germans would think it was a new escape method. Whether that's true, I'm not sure. This particular aircraft was shot down by Night Fighter just north of Frankfurt. Eyewitnesses say that this aircraft, as it was passing north of Frankfurt, clear night in the moonlight, and they could see aircraft flying, I suppose, a little bit like geese in formation. And flak batteries were engaging the aircraft. Searchlights combed this particular aircraft. The flak stopped, and in came a night fighter and shot his aircraft down. The aircraft came down on a hillside outside the village of Stockholm, near Glauberg, and it actually crashed onto this hillside here. We have an aerial photograph just at the end of the war, which shows the damage done to the forest in this area because of the crash site. Burnt area of trees and so on Apparently a lot of incendiaries burning in that area. The aircraft, I think, did jettison its 4,000-pound cookie bomb before it came down. It was seen to spiral down into the trees, and eyewitnesses say that, sadly, some of the crew were still alive in the aircraft as it came into the trees and sadly passed away there. This is what the site looks like now. So we're working just in this area, so where the crash site is, and you can see, even amongst the forest now, you can see the different foliage. The trees are growing differently. In fact, the trees are slightly stunted, and all the leaves tend to fall off the trees a little bit earlier in this area, presumably because the nutrients in the ground are being spoilt by contaminants. So our methodology really here, thinking about recording crash sites, is to work within the wooded area and record all of the objects that we can find within the surface, the undergrowth. Because it's in woodland, GPS doesn't work very well. That would be the nice, easy way to record the position of all these objects. So we're using electronic total station to 3D record the position of every single object that we find. So we go through, sweep with a metal detector. In fact, we had a group of students from Saxon University in Daventer and some from Winchester using very basic metal detectors, stuff you can buy for 100 quid. Nothing fancy, and this was perfect for picking up bits of the wreckage. And each object was 3D recorded. Sometimes we record groups together because, you know, if there's sort of 50 small pieces, and there's no point in recording the position of every single one of them. That allowed us to produce a distribution like this. You can see this is overlaid on LiDAR data, so this is a kind of topographic backdrop, and you can see there's a slight hollow here, and this is actually the impact spot where the Lancaster came down. Eyewitnesses say it was tipped up on its end, nose down. It didn't impact straight into the ground. It sort of cartwheeled into the trees. And what we've been doing is sweeping around it, working gradually out. So this is not all the objects on the crash site. This is just a single season's worth of work. So each one of these numbers represents an object or group of objects. We could drill down further into this and see the distribution of specific types of objects as well. Ammunition, perspex, and so on, bits of the aircraft. But this allows us to show what the crash site actually looked like. It's particularly informative when you look at it in relation to the burnt area. So we see that, in fact, whilst this, you know, you might initially think that this is the whole of the crash site. In fact, the crash site is up this end. Then you get this burnt area behind. Of course, distributions of artifacts are one thing, but you can also look at distributions of crash sites themselves in order to say something about a particular operation and how it unfolded. In this case, this is the Nuremberg raid, the infamous Nuremberg raid, on the night of the 30th, 31st of March 1944. And this is from Martin Middlebrook's work on the subject, which is an excellent study, of course, and familiar to some of you, I've no doubt. And this shows the distribution of aircraft shot down on that operation. The bomber stream of some 700 aircraft was intercepted by night fighters more or less in this area. And in the hour after midnight on this particular operation, a huge number of aircraft were lost, some 95. I mean, the numbers vary a little bit depending on how you measure them. But you can see the effect of this infiltration of the bomber stream, and you can see distribution of crash sites all around. So it's a really interesting way of looking how an operation unfolds. Visually, really allows you to understand what happened. Of course, you can see aircraft still being lost on the way home. One of the aircraft lost on this particular operation was Halifax LV-881, 10 Squadron. This is the crew. In fact, four of these chaps were killed in what unfolded. If I just go back a slide, their aircraft is number 46, I think, this one here. As you can see, they're right in the middle of it, flying along in the dark, and they're attacked. They think it's flak hits them underneath. There's a bang under the wing. They think because it's come from underneath, it must be flak. They carry on flying straight, which is their undoing, I think. And of course, it's a night fighter. Pops some rounds straight into the fuel tanks in exactly the same spot 5 minutes later, and down they go. And they explode. The aircraft explodes about 6,000 feet and sprays debris. This is the aerodrome where they took off from, RAF Melbourne in Yorkshire. You can see their dispersal was probably somewhere on this side of the Perry track, and they've come all the way around, taken off down the main runway here. The tower still exists, and some of the other buildings too. So it flies from Melbourne and then is destroyed above this village in Germany, Steinheim, and wreckage descends into the forest again. It seems that I get a lot of time spent in mosquito-ridden, insect-ridden forests. And this is our students working away on an area, a concentration of material in the forest. So metal detector sweep through the forest, identify concentrations, and this is in fact where one of the main parts of the fuselage came down. aircraft split into pieces. You can see here, this is our sort of schematic map of how the debris landed. So you can see a lot of the bomb load, mainly incendiaries, have dropped in this area. This is the direction of travel of the aircraft as it comes down. Then you've got engines distributed, heavy objects sort of sprayed. This thing is spiraling out of control, and the heavy objects are sprayed out in this direction. And the nose of the aircraft comes down here, and the central fuselage carries on a bit further. You can see the destructive force of the crash. Of course, most of what you recover, it looks like this, and this sort of raises an issue. What do you do with this once you've collected it? A headache for museum curators, no doubt. But you do have some nicer objects. This is probably the lens from the onboard camera. As they go over the fly of the target, they take a photograph of the bombs actually dropping to see how accurate the op was. Also, instruments from the instrument panel and so on. You can see various items here. But crucially here, you can also see personal objects. So this is a forage cap badge, and you can see it's RAAF. So it belongs to the only Australian member of this crew. So we identify exactly who this belonged to. This is Hugh Birch. Hugh Birch was the mid-upper gunner, and he was killed probably in the initial attack by the night fighter. His central fuselage of the aircraft was peppered with rounds, and he probably bled to death before the aircraft exploded. He was found sitting, looking fairly peaceful in the mid-upper turret as it was resting on the ground after the crash. This object was sent back to his family in Australia by the Australian Embassy in Berlin and given to Hugh Birch's his nephew. And you can see here the presentation of that. So a really nice thing to do. But again, this is sort of ties in with who owns these objects, who do they belong to. This particular project was really interesting because we brought family members of the crew to see the site, some of whom who had lost family members in this particular incident. So they were able to come to the very spot where their loved ones were. And it's quite interesting to see that reaction, to see how powerful that experience is for them. And again, I think it's something that really tells us how important these sites can be to people. We were able to make new contacts. So the two chaps either side here are the sons of the flight engineer who thankfully survived this incident. And his account is very instructive. But this is meeting one of the eyewitnesses who saw the bodies laid out at the crash site. And, it was quite an emotional experience for all of them involved. But this reminds us that this kind of crash site heritage can link places that seem such a long way apart. So this is Melbourne, the main runway where the aircraft took off. And this is the hillside on which the aircraft finally crashed. These two places are now inextricably linked by this particular incident. And, of course, attending the ceremony, the memorial service, helps to create new bonds of friendship to help understand what happened, but it's now part of the story of this particular village, this particular place, and it holds a special place in the heart of the people who visited, and of course bringing members of different armed services together for that service. And it's a reminder, I think, that aircraft, sounds obvious, of course, aircraft travelling from one place to another, but they ignore terrestrial boundaries. It's not a typical kind of heritage. It moves over great distances, takes off from one place, lands in another perhaps, or crashes in this case in another place altogether. And they involve multinational crews, a crew from several different nations, a very common thing, of course. And this issue reminds us also that in different nations, we have very different approaches to these crash sites. The UK controls access to crash sites via licensing, the MOD, and prefers generally to leave human remains in situ, which is potentially controversial for some. In the US, they recover these. They have a team that will go around the globe trying to recover human remains, even small items. The Netherlands, you have a situation where it's the military that deal with these sites, not archaeologists. They're literally recovering the dangerous objects. I mean, the argument is that, of course, they are dangerous, potentially dangerous sites. So it's the preserve of the Dutch Royal Air Force. And in Germany, for example, you have individual states with different attitudes to excavating these sites, to curating them. And it raises the issue, who has the right to decide what happens to these crash sites? The nation where they reside, the original owners of the aircraft, the relatives who are linked to the crew. And what we found is that collaboration and a case-by-case approach is most important. I'm going to try and whip through these, and Harry, please nod if I'm taking too much time. I'll show you a few different examples of projects been working on. So this is the excavation of Hurricane P-366 at Fobbing Marsh, Pitsea Marsh, sorry, in Essex. This aircraft was shot down the 26th of August, 1940. And this was flown by John Hemingway. And here he is with some other members of 85 Squadron, and a gentleman there that you'll probably recognise, Peter Townsend. We're lucky that John Hemingway is still with us, and I think he had his 100th birthday last year. And here he is with a painting commissioned by Mark Postlethwaite, presented to him last year to commemorate the work we did on this particular crash site. Now, very challenging to do some work on a site like this. The impact hole was some 30 feet deep, and you have Vange Creek here, which is intertidal, and you have water coming up right close to the crash site, and previous attempts to recover this these remains couldn't achieve it. So we've got a big machine on here, and there's no way I'm going to get in a hole like that. There's a big machine digging it all out, spreading it on the side. There's a closer look at the hole, so you can see what happens here. Dig it all out, and then it's spread out here. This is a traditional wreck recovery method, and a team of ant-like volunteers goes through the objects, sifting everything. And some of these guys are extremely experienced, pick out even small objects within that. I'm sort of straying off the RAF topic here, but I just want to show you this example. This is a BF-110 twin-engined night fighter aircraft that we excavated in Germany, in Hessen. And I show you because it illustrates quite nicely some of the things you can do with these sites. I'm thinking about excavating them, but also recording them. These are the forward-mounted cannons which drove themselves into the ground. I can't dig these with a trowel like you see archaeologists doing. You have to hoist these out with a big machine. Loads of interesting personal items, pilot's sidearm, bits of the tyres and so on. But what I really want to show you is this. So this is a style of excavation which allows me to photograph what I've been doing and help explain it to you. So what you're looking at here is a sort of half section through the crash. This is where the central fuselage hit the ground, so it came in at a 45 degree angle. And these represent the impact areas for both the engines. So there were human remains in here which we had to sift through and recover, completely different than you do in the UK. But all of that was in here, bits of the parachute and so on, all squashed in there. But also you get this side view. So this is one, you can see there's a central fuselage, but this is the one of the engines gone in here. They pulled out the engine block, but you can see the angle of the impact with this line here. Another aircraft that we looked at just recently, Hurricane N2608 of 213 Squadron. This is flown by Hugh Desmond Clark. Crashed on the 1st of November, of course, the day after the official Battle of Britain ended. He was doing much of the same as he was doing before. Joint project with people like Steve Vizard, Simon Parry, Gareth Jones, guys who do this stuff all the time, working with our students, so our students experiencing different kind of archaeology. And we're standing in the crash impact area of this hurricane. Hugh Clark bailed out of this aircraft, so there's no problem with human remains on board. But what we did is we excavated a slice through the actual impact area, and what you can see here is exactly that. So the bottom area here is where the remains of the aircraft were, pulled most of it out, recovery at the time, and then some backfill at the top here. This rather wishful thinking looking hole here is actually the inboard area of the wings, inboard of the undercarriage, and you could actually see a slight bow wave, if you like, where the front of the nose of the aircraft had driven into the ground. You know, taking this kind of photo, excavating it in this way and taking this kind of photograph allows me to explain that to you in a way that's not usually possible. Here's some objects from the crash, and you can see here the firing button, of course, armoured glass and so on. Okay, so I'm just going to skim for a few of these. What do we do with materials from crash sites? Raises the question. Who owns them? Who owns the remains of aircraft? Who owns the personal objects? And who owns the human remains in some cases? Who should deal with this? And also, I think it's worth raising the issue of there's usually a legal answer to these things, but is there also a moral question here, which we need to address? I'm going to skip through this fairly briefly, but suffice to say that in the UK, the primary legislation is the Protection of Military Remains Act, and this has some issues to do with it. Some things are not considered within the licensing process that allows you to excavate crash sites. Usually it's presence or absence of human remains and live ordnance. If there's either of those two things on, you don't get a license. But it doesn't consider whether an aircraft is a prototype, whether it's unique, whether it's an experimental aircraft and so on, who it's flown by, what operation it took part in. One of the crash sites we're looking at on Thorney Island is a JU-88 crash site. And our experience here has really highlighted some of the problems with the current system. If the crash site is not located, you can't protect it. You need to know where it is. There's human remains present on this site, so I wouldn't get a license to excavate it, but I want to try and find it. Our aim was to try and locate this crash site using non-intrusive geophysical survey. But how can I prove that I found that particular aircraft if I can't dig any of it out of the ground? As soon as I recover anything from the site, I'm in breach of the Military Remains Act because there was human remains on it. So unless I pull something out of the ground, how do I prove that this is this crash site? Well, A, prove it's a crash site at all. B, prove it's this crash site and not another one because several aircraft crashed on the aerodrome. So how can the Act apply to a site that's not been positively identified? So one of the things we're suggesting are to create a full register of historic aircraft crash sites in the UK. This has been partly done by MPP with Historic England, but we need to build on this. We also need to think about extending this into European context because half of the remains we're talking about have disappeared from the UK and are in foreign fields. We need to absorb this information within historic environment records so that people who are dealing with development in the planning process have this information on their databases, on their heritage databases, and can use it to help modify the work that goes on building sites. We need to develop regional thematic research agendas so we can target particular sites for greater detailed research. We need to develop the licensing process further to be a bit more subtle, to be a bit more reactive, and explore ways to collaborate with partners in Europe. It's a bad time to be talking about that, isn't it? But it's something that would be extremely useful to us to deal with some of the material coming out of these sites. Final few things. We also need to improve the excavation and recording of crash sites so that we can tell the story better. And we need to improve the reporting of work that goes along with this. Finally, we need to have greater dialogue between the various stakeholders involved. There's been too much talk about recologists, amateurs, professional archaeologists, and all the people who are interested in these sites. There are an awful lot of people who have great expertise in this field, whatever you call them. They need to come together and actually work out the best way to develop protection for these sites. Okay, I think that's all I want to say.
Thank you very much, Phil. We've got Loz Atkinson next.
Hi, everyone. So my name is Loz Atkinson. I'm a multidisciplinary artist and have been practicing for over 10 years. I'm mostly known for my painting, usually, which involve clouds and geometry and outer space. And a lot of my work is about looking up. But with this project, Expedition JP237, which was sponsored by the Arts Council, I have to mention that, we physically went up. My perspective on today's topic is from a very personal point of view and an artistic point of view. And the story starts with my great-grandfather, who is this lovely gentleman right here. His name's Arthur Pinder. He was born in 1903, and throughout his life he did many things. He was part of the West Yorkshire Regiment and got out quite cleverly before the start of the war. He was also a railway porter and worked for the Royal Mail. He had 7 children with my great-grandmother, Frieda, one of which was my granddad, Roy Pinder, and that's how I know the stories of Arthur. He joined the RAF in 1941, and this is the part of the story that really started to intrigue me, because if you, like it says here, if you know anything about air crew at that time, there was a cut-off age of 33, and when he joined up, he was 38. Which was very old for air crew. So whether there was a bit of don't ask, don't tell, or he fibbed a little bit to have his chance to fly, I suppose we'll never know. So this detail, again, intrigued me to do more research about him and what happened to him. So here he is here with the rest of his crew. So by all accounts from stories from my granddad, they were quite a tight-knit group, with stories of them all coming to Arthur's house for dinner and card games and dominoes and all that lovely stuff. We don't have many personal effects from Arthur left in the family, but one of the things we do have is his 1944 RAF diary. And he didn't write a lot in that, but he does actually mention Don, who was the pilot there, and Robbie, Dixie and Nikki, who from the list of their names you can guess who's who. So they were posted out to Brindisi in South Italy, where they flew Mark II Halifaxes, part of Special Operations Executive 148 Squadron. Together, they flew over 205 hours of operational flight time and 31 sorties, which, depending what info you look at, a tour is classed sometimes as 30 sorties or between 200 and 250 hours of operational flight time, so which makes this slightly a bit more tragic because this could have been one of their last flights. But yeah, so in that time they dropped 11.4 tons of nickels, which were propaganda leaflets, 288 containers, 453 packages, and two personnel over Romania, Yugoslavia, which is now Bosnia-Herzegovina, Hungary, Italy, Albania. They were supplying resistance and partisan forces with much-needed ammunition, food, clothing, equipment, radio equipment. Again, a pivotal role within the war. So unfortunately, like I was saying, one of their last missions was on the 23rd of June, 1944, where Arthur and his crew prepared Halifax Mark II JP-237, which the project is named after, F for Freddy, for Operation Sound 1, over a new target in northern Italy. Takeoff was 2,100 hours, but nothing was heard from the crew after takeoff, so it was presumed lost. The crew had only joined 148 Squadron in March 1944, and again, if any of you know about Halifax crews, unfortunately, they never really lasted that long, as they were kind of the pack horses of the war and kind of easy targets, I guess. So reports from the time suggest the aircraft was shot down over northern Italy, which, and there's the mountain that it is actually crashed into. And yeah, so Arthur and the entire crew were killed in action in the early hours of 24th of June, with the operations record expressing the loss of such an excellent crew was a sad blow to the squadron, which again is quite a nice poignant, because not all crews were mentioned in these logbooks. From local sort of reports, the plane crashed in the early hours. The locals didn't bother to go up when it was dark. They waited until the morning. Again, a very violent scene. The plane sort of strewn all over. They collected the remains of the men and buried them respectfully with partisan soldiers giving them full military honours, and they were buried in a local cemetery near to Mount Zata. The priest that actually conducted that ceremony was then put under intimidation by the local sort of Nazis, but survived, and thankfully so. So this leads us to 75 years later. So through my research online, finding out what happened to the aircraft, I came across Francesco Sabini, who is next to me over there. You'll see a lot more of him in a minute. Through his research, which was a lot online, I contacted him to see if he'd be interested in helping me with the project, which he was very excited about. And he had found the crash 10 years previous to this. Also adding the amazingly talented Zoe Childerly to the team, we went out and climbed the mountain. So, in July last year, we went up. On the first day, we climbed to the peak of the mountain, which is 1,355 meters, which, just a little fun fact, that's higher than Ben Nevis. And, yeah, when we got up there, we watched the sunset, and it was just an absolutely incredible experience. So this is a couple of images from the climb up to the peak. Again, quite similar to your pictures. On one side of the mountain, it's very cliffy and rocky. On the other side is very dense beech forest. And on the way was this building, which Francesco called the Shining Hotel, which was very true. It was very creepy. There'd been a thunderstorm that afternoon, so this doesn't do it justice how much the mountain was enveloped in cloud and mist, and it was almost like we had a film crew come in and like put the atmosphere that, you know, that we needed or that seemed fitting for what we were doing. And then this is the view from the top. Francesco thinks that the plane came from this direction, was shot within that area and sort of skimmed the top of the mountain and then sort of spread out all down the other side within the trees. An absolutely amazing experience. It's really hard to sort of convey what it meant to me to do this, being so personally connected to it. But yeah, a little serendipitous thing was on the way down, we had to climb down in the dark, which got a bit Blair Witch Project. At one point, the forest was absolutely covered in fireflies, which just these little twinkly lights breaking up the darkness. And I know this is a bit, maybe sound a bit cheesy, but in that moment, you could really tell why ancient people thought these were the spirits of our ancestors, which, again, very poignant to what we were doing at that time. So over the next couple of days, we explored the actual crash site, which was in the thick of the beech trees at an elevation of 1,169, which, again, another fun fact, that's higher than Mount Snowdon. On those days, we searched for artifacts from the plane. We collected GPS data. I created artworks into the landscape. Again, the photos don't do it justice, really, of how steep and how sort of treacherous. I'm not exactly the fittest person, so it's very difficult to climb. But luckily, I could break it up by doing the artwork. But yeah, if you didn't know it had happened there, you wouldn't. I mean, I imagine if you went with your aerial, you could totally tell. But just being on the ground, there's no tree loss. There's no obvious scars into the landscape. If you didn't know it happened, you wouldn't know. And there's no large parts of the aircraft, as at the time the locals just absolutely stripped it. At that time, obviously, aluminium, everything would have been very valuable. So they just took everything off the mountain. Francesco said they built cable car systems to get it down. So they were very determined, I think. So yeah, nature has very much reclaimed that area. So here's some pictures of Francesco and me searching for parts of the wreckage. I mean, he was absolutely amazing. A lot of the times he could just see it by eye or by moving a few leaves or moving a rock to one side. Francesco first read about the crash site in a local partisan forces history book with just a tiny little paragraph, and it just hooked him. And yeah, he found the crash site over 10 years ago. And just little pieces everywhere. And I was quite proud. I managed to find, because I've brought some pieces with me, some of the perspex from the cockpit area or a turret. And they were just on some rocks, which, again, just blew my mind. After 75 years, there they are, just there. Again, an absolutely beautiful place that you'd never guess that anything so tragic had happened there, with just birds singing, the mosquitoes. I can really feel for your pain in that one. And the only thing that broke it up every now and then was the beep from Francesco's metal detector. So here's some examples of some of the things that we found on our trip and some from Francesco's collection. Some items, so that up there is a torch that maybe the navigator would have used. This is a section of the box that the sextant would have been in. That is a piece of the parachute silk. There's the dipstick knob. This is a clip that the parachutes would have attached to the containers, I think. And then, heartbreakingly, buttons from their uniforms, a heel from one of their flying boots, and, yeah, again, heartbreakingly, one of their gold watches. So, again, I've bought some of these things that we found while we were up there here. So if you want to come and have a look afterwards, you're welcome to. So leaving Francesco to searching for more of the artifacts, I began to make works within the landscape, and these are a few examples of the works that I made. So this piece I've called Reliquary. It's some 24-karat gold leaf put onto the bedrock of the mountain. This subverts Christian iconography, where a reliquary would hold relics of saints. So by doing this to the mountain bedrock, makes that whole mountain a reliquary, as it holds the relics of that aircraft and those men's ultimate sacrifice. This piece, yellow ribbon, was made by wrapping yellow ribbon around one of the trees. Yellow ribbon is traditionally used as a symbol of hope or remembrance. So the hope of the safe return of a loved one, which sadly for Arthur and those men was not the case, and then to remember those that we have lost. Having this work on the site of such a tragic loss creates a really powerful piece highlighting the importance of remembering those individual sacrifices. So this one is kind of a weird one, I think, but I think it holds sort of a nice message. So it's called Threads. So as well as tracking our movements on the site digitally, I did it physically using rope in a kind of Theseus and the Minotaur kind of way. I think it's a human nature to want to leave traces of ourselves behind, to be remembered, but also know where we have come from. And this work creates tangible lines of connectivity between us and the past. The golden cord was then collected back up and balled up, essentially creating a map of our movements, as it somehow holds that information, but it can never be read or understood, much like the universal human need to want to connect with our heritage. Where does that come from, and can we ever truly satisfy that need? So this one is a bit hard to talk about, so I'm sorry if I get a lump in my throat. But this picture this was a sound piece that will only ever be played once on the mountainside. I asked my granddad, who I mentioned before, Roy, who has now sadly passed away, who is Arthur's son, to record a message to his dad, which he graciously agreed to, and we played it out onto the mountainside into the site. So it's an unconditional, enduring love captured, then released out into a fittingly grand setting, a hugely symbolic, beautifully harrowing and profound gesture, all held in a pretty innocuous photograph. So I was really happy with this piece, which is still in situ on the mountain, actually. All of the other things we tried to take away, so not to leave an environmental impact on the mountain. This bridge wasn't actually on the crash site, it was on the way to it. So, and Francesco started shouting at me when I started to try and unravel it. He was like, leave it there. But yeah, I was really happy with this piece. I love that it was completely serendipitous that this beautiful, decrepit old bridge would just happen to be there. So it's very fortuitous. It continues the themes used in the wrapped tree piece from before, but the symbology goes a little bit further, literally bridging the gap between us and the past, again highlighting the importance of remembering and learning from those who have gone before us, giving a safe passage to a better future. Because if we don't learn from the past, we are doomed to repeat it. And I think this is very apt for these times that we're in at the minute. So as another thing we did while we were there, we placed two commemorative plates. Again, Francesco, crazy mountain man that he is, dragging up all this equipment to be able to do that. So one of them to commemorate the crew and one to commemorate the expedition and my relationship with Arthur. At the end of our time on the mountain, we journeyed to Genoa to the monumental cemetery of Stagliano, which is an absolutely huge necropolis set into a hillside overlooking Genoa, where Arthur and the crew are laid side by side, which is kind of not true, unfortunately, as through my research through MOD records, it was only possible to identify two of the crew, and the rest of them were kind of buried together. So, but they're all their headstones are lined up side by side, including a Yugoslavian sort of secret agent guy who I didn't know anything about, but he's on here as well. Again, a hugely emotional experience. And again, this is really cheesy, but it did happen. With church bells in the background, we lay a single white rose for each of the men representing Arthur's Yorkshire heritage. And again, an incredible fitting end to our incredible journey. So this is Mount Zatter from afar, this here. And that's my somewhat unusual experience of aviation crash sites. A little insight into a personal transformative pilgrimage with the work created in tribute to my great-grandfather, which was conducted with great respect and reverence for the place and the men. I hope, overall, the work inspires people to connect with their heritage or to embark on their own adventures to inspire future generations. And on that note, if you want to find out more about this work and some more artwork that I've created since, you're welcome to come to the exhibition that will be held in Leicester in May. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Loz. That was brilliant. I actually really like Fred's as a in-situ piece of work. So we've got Ian Fursk now. He's going to talk partly about the Dornier recovery, which the museum did a few years ago now. And then we're going to move on into our question session.
Right. So good afternoon, everybody. 7 years ago, I was lucky enough to lead the one of the museum's most ambitious projects, if you like. It was one of the most exciting and challenging things we've ever done. It was the recovery and conservation of the Goodwin Sands Dornier DO17. In June 2013, the project received worldwide coverage and featured live on BBC News as millions of viewers tuned in to witness the aircraft being raised from the Dover Straits. The size, scope, and technical ambition of the project captured the imagination and pushed the envelope in terms of methodology. But let's just start with the background to this and how it all began. In 2005, a Ramsgate fisherman snagged his nets on one of the many wrecks on the Goodwin Sands, about a mile off the coast at Deal. The fisherman reported this find to local diver Bob Peacock. Bob's made a detailed study of the various wrecks along the Goodwin Sands coastline. They're notoriously dangerous and contain the wrecks of over 1,000 ships and numerous aircraft. They're known locally as the ship's swallowers. Bob investigated further in regards to this aircraft and discovered his nets were caught on the remains of a largely intact aeroplane lying in 50 feet of water. He reported the find to Wessex Archaeology, and in 2008 and 2009, during survey work for English Heritage, Wessex carried out some sonar scans of the wreck site. What they discovered was quite spectacular, and revealed the ghostly outline of a largely intact twin-engine aeroplane emerging from the shifting sands. The wreck resembled a wartime German Dornier 17 bomber, a type previously thought to be extinct, and a mainstay of the German Luftwaffe during the Battle of Britain. Wessex sent the images to us here at the RAF Museum, and we were immediately very excited because here was a potential opportunity to acquire an example of an aircraft type that was missing from our Battle of Britain types collection. As you all know, the Luftwaffe operated three main bomber types in the Battle of Britain, the Dornier 17, the Heinkel 111, and the Junkers 88. We retain examples of the Heinkel and the Junkers, both much later variants, but nowhere in the world was a Dornier 17 known to exist. What's more, this aircraft had the potential to be linked to an iconic event in English history, the Battle of Britain, so it certainly appeared worth investigating further to save for the nation. So, based on the Wessex sonar images, we decided to conduct our own dive survey of the wreck, and we commissioned Wessex to do this for us back in 2012. Now, the primary objectives of the survey were, one, confirm the aeroplane type. Was it, for example, a Dornier 17? Or was it a Dornier 217, the slightly larger example that came later on? Secondly, did it have any bombs or guns aboard? Thirdly, most importantly, were there any signs of human remains? As Phil mentioned earlier on, you need to acquire a license from the MOD to recover the aeroplane. If human remains are on board, it's a no-go. And fourthly, to assess the overall condition of the aircraft. Now, the survey proved that the aircraft was indeed a Dornier 17Z and remarkably intact, considering the amount of time it had spent on the seabed. Various things we looked at during the survey were Dornier 17Z, it's got the Bramo Fafnir 9-cylinder radial engine, so the diver could check the number of cylinders for that. Also, you've got peculiarities on the 17Z. You've got the elevator mass balance weight, which is protrudes top of the tailplane. That was checked as well. But which actual aircraft was this, and how did it end up on the Goodwin Sands? Now, in order to obtain a recovery license from the Ministry of Defence, it was vital to provide evidence of the Dornier's identity. So we approached the historical branch to come up with some ideas. And I see Seb's in the audience across there. They were remarkably helpful, and they came up with three candidates. Now, two of these aircraft were known to crash into the sea and were destroyed. But a third, Dornier 17Z-2, 5KAR of 7KG3, is recorded as having made a forced landing on the Goodwin Sands at low tide on August 26, 1940, following combat with RAF fighters. It's this particular aircraft which we believe to be the identity of the Goodwin Sands wreck. But what actually happened on August 26, 1940? This is Dornier 17 5KAR of 7KG3. We're not clear it's the actual aeroplane that we have today, but it certainly did serve with that unit. Now, Monday, August 26, 1940, was yet another day in the Battle of Britain when the Germans attempted to destroy fighter commander aerodromes. The previous day had seen attacks to the airfields in the west of England, but today it was a turn of aerodromes in the east. Now, rather than approach their targets over land, the majority of the attackers approached over the Thames estuary, turning north or south as required. At Saint-Trond Aerodrome in Belgium, nine Dornier 17s of 7KG3 took off to attack the RAF aerodrome at Manston in Kent. The attack was timed for 12:20 hours. The German bombers followed the North Kent coast, turning inland between Herne Bay and Westgate to attack Manston from the north. It was now, as the formation approached the Kent coast and prepared to turn southwards, that RAF fighters, including Bolton Paul Defiance of 264 Squadron, tried to intercept. It was 264 Squadron's task to attack the bombers. They were asked to patrol over Dover and were vectored towards the Herne Bay Deal area to intercept the Dorniers. Mindful of the escorting Messerschmitt 109 fighters, 264 successfully attacked the formation from underneath. In the ensuing confused combats, 264 Squadron claimed to have destroyed six Dornier 17s and damaged a further one. Dornier 17 5KAR was badly crippled and at 13:40 hours made a forced landing on the Goodwin Sands at low tide. Willie F. Mert, the pilot, and Herman Ritzel, the observer, were the only two survivors and were made prisoners of war. The body of the radio operator, Helmut Reinhardt, was later washed ashore in Holland, while the body of the gunner, Heinz Hune, was washed ashore in the UK. Reinhardt now lies in a German cemetery in Holland, while Hune is interred in a German cemetery at Cannock Chase in Staffordshire, very close to where the Dornier is now located at Cosford. Now, here's a mock-up done by our art department, which shows the Dornier 17 5KAR. So following a dive survey, we made the rather ambitious decision to recover the Dornier, but there were clearly several hurdles to leap across first. Firstly, how much was it going to cost? Estimates were £500,000. Secondly, licences. The MOD SPVA said yes, a recovery licence. And the Marine Management Organisation, quite a new organisation, wanted a licence too because they were concerned about possible contaminants from the aeroplane polluting the surrounding seabed. We underwent 2 years then of research to establish a recovery methodology and a conservation methodology. But to better inform the recovery operation, we commissioned the Port of London Authority to conduct a multi-beam echo sound of the wreck site, plus the surrounding seabed up to about 250 metres. The PLA were really, really helpful to us throughout the whole operation. They were very, very supportive, and they did this work for an incredibly low fee. The aircraft had been, we think, covered and uncovered over a course of about 50 years through various storms. The majority of the time it remained under the sand, which is why it was in such good condition and why it was so intact. So, as part of our recovery research, etc., etc., we thought we must go and speak to people who've done this kind of thing before. Notably, the Norwegians, who are very experienced in the recovery of German aircraft from marine environments. Admittedly, from freshwater environments, but they have done some saltwater ones. We went to the Norwegian Armed Forces collection at Oslo Gardermoen to see a Junkers 88, and to the Norwegian Aviation Museum at Bodø. This is the 88 on the left-hand side being recovered, and the Heinkel 111 on the right. The Norwegians told us that following recovery, keep the aeroplane wet. You must keep it saturated. This is vital because the first 48 hours are the most critical. During that period, they told us, you'll be able to undo connecting nuts and bolts on major assemblies. We thought they were absolutely mad to say that, but we bore that one in mind. This is the Junkers 88 A1, which you saw in the first picture. This is being conserved at Gardermoen, and it's making very good progress now. Meanwhile, our fundraising efforts were making headway, and thanks to a very generous £343,000 grant from the National Heritage Memorial Fund, we were able to appoint a contractor to do the recovery operation. The company were called SeaTech Civil and Marine of Southampton. We also got a number of technical manuals from EADS, the modern successor to Dornier, including some drawings, and they were absolutely invaluable. Now, in deference to the Dornier's extremely fragile state following 70 years of saltwater immersion, our recovery methodology originally centred on constructing a bespoke lifting frame around the aeroplane, as you can see here. The objective being here that the frame would take the stresses involved rather than the airframe itself. This was a modular construction and could be used afterwards to support the aircraft when we got it to the conservation centre. And see here the frame built around the aeroplane. The plan was it would be assembled on the seabed around it, and then we'd lift the frame off the seabed. But of course, it didn't quite work out like that. Most importantly, there was no point in raising the Dornier if we got no means of conserving it once it was extracted from the seabed. Now, one of the project's great success stories has been the forging of a relationship with Imperial College. Now, previous attempts to conserve aeroplanes that had been removed from saltwater environments had not proved hugely successful. It was vital, therefore, to seek professional guidance in order to prepare the conservation task. So Imperial College Royal School of Mines were approached for advice and were extremely keen to assist. They assigned three PhD students to conduct research based upon fragments that we'd recovered from the seabed. They were incredibly helpful, and without them we could never have done this, and very enthusiastic as well. Professor Mary Ryan on the right-hand side, she was in charge of all of this. And Amy Cruikshank on the left, she was a New Zealand PhD student who was assigned solely to this, and she did some incredibly groundbreaking work, actually. Now, I'm not a metallurgist or a chemist, but I can only tell you what they told me. But basically, taking a sample of aluminium skin from the aeroplane, Imperial set out to identify the alloy composition employed in Madornier's airframe. Results had showed that the alloy was largely aluminium and magnesium based, but contained precipitates of iron, silicon, and manganese. The Imperial team believed that Madornier's remarkable state of preservation could be due to the inherent lack of copper in the alloy. Copper would have been removed because it reduced the corrosion resistance and often caused intergranular failure. This additionally brought the bonus of allowing sea life to settle on the structure, as copper is biotoxic in large quantities. We think the sea life coating had helped to preserve the wreck by forming a barrier. Now, Imperial developed their own cleaning and drying process, which is outlined here. Following cleaning and drying, hydroxide layers form, and it is this which has to be addressed in order to arrest corrosion. To sample this, Imperial had been developing a composition based on citric acid, plain lemon juice, basically. This produced very encouraging results by purging the aggressive chloride salt layers from the aluminium. Once fully cleaned, we intend to protect the surface of the airframe structure at a later date with a protective coating, but research is still going on to do that. These two photographs were taken with an electron microscope, and so the sample piece before it was untreated, and secondly, after cleaning. Now, I mentioned before, we needed to conserve it once it came out of the water. So to do this, we developed a conservation facility at Cosford, next to the Michael Beetham Conservation Centre. What we did basically was to construct two large hydration tunnels, not for tomatoes, but for the aeroplane. Each one measured about 20 metres in length, 7 metres wide, and 3.5 metres high. One contained the fuselage, and the other the Dornier's one-piece wing. The each tunnel was equipped with a moisture spray system, which atomised the atmosphere, dispersed through 16 nozzles hanging down through the ceiling. Additional directional spray tubes were located on the floor to cover the underside of the fuselage and the wings. The system was fed by a 3,000-litre tank containing the citric acid solution developed by Imperial College. The solution dispersed through a drainage system located in the floor before passing through filters, which constantly became clogged with marine organisms afterwards, but you can imagine that, and then back into the tank where it was recirculated through the pumping house. By adopting this approach, we remove the need to immerse the airframe into a large tank with all the inherent issues you have of, obviously, you've got problems with environmental problems and disease, et cetera, Legionnaire's disease. But more importantly, we could control the timing of the hydration system by switching it off when we wanted to walk in and inspect the airframe. This approach was innovative, never been done before in the conservation of a large airplane from salt water. And also, by doing it this way, we could allow the public to watch the whole thing being done during the course of the conservation. Moving on to the recovery operation, this is all very brief, but it was such a huge project. Work began on May the 31st, 2013, and it was planned to last 31 days. The principal vessels employed were the crane barge, the GPS Apollo, which you can see here, with a large crane at the foredeck, and also the flat-top dumb barge, the Boxer. We were restricted in terms of visibility, and we could only work for about twice a day because visibility was incredibly poor, and because of slack water periods, we were quite limited to the time we could spend on the seabed with the divers. But nevertheless, on the first weekend, things went exceptionally well, began to make progress, and the frame sections began to be taken down to the wreck. We also had a visit from this is Joe Prill, who was the SeaTech dive coordinator. He was a remarkable chap, master of ceremonies, to watch him work and coordinate divers at the same time. We had a visit from Conrado Dornier, who, of course, is the grandson of Claudius Dornier, who formed the Dornier Company. He was incredibly enthusiastic and interested. He flew in his own seaplane, as you do, and spent a couple of days with us, actually, on board the barge, which is fabulous. Anyway, obviously, before we did the recovery, we'd looked at long-range weather forecasts, and we'd been assured that May looked good. We were going to be fine. Anyway, everything changed after that. It was the worst weather conditions in UK in May for about 200 years. This became a view that I got far too fed up with. Basically, we were in Ramsgate Harbour for 2 of the 4 weeks due to weather downtime. It was costing us about £14,000 per day to live in there, which was not good. The big issue really was wave swell and height. It was a very flat-top barge and needed to be in calm conditions to do the job. We lived aboard it for about a month, and it was not the most comfortable places, but that's the way it worked out, really. However, local knowledge of tidal currents and conditions helped us in trying to determine, you know, another good window. But because of the changes and the delays and the fact that the funding was starting to run out, we had to look at changing our lifting methodology. Also, the seabed geology was proving challenging. It was on a chalk bed, which we initially thought would be fairly easy to channel through to put the frame assemblies in position. But no, that didn't work out. It was incredibly hard to get through. So we realized that the only way we could lift the aeroplane was by actually attaching lifting strops to the airframe itself. That was the very thing that I didn't want to do, but in the circumstances, it was the only chance that we'd got. Now, in this respect, the aircraft's position was in our favour, really. Because the aeroplane was upside down, it gave us access to the bomb bay. And for lightness, weight and simplicity, the Dornier 17, like the de Havilland Mosquito and the Harrier, features a one-piece wing. I say the bomb doors were torn off in the forced landing, so we had direct access through the bomb bay to the front and rear spar booms of the wing. Now, experience had shown that all the parts that were retrieved from beneath the seabed were in remarkably good condition, so we believe that the spar booms would be the same way. That proved to be the case, actually. So this was a piece from the BBC who followed the project very closely, as you probably remember at the time. And this is on their website, but basically that shows what we had to do. We lifted from the front and rear spar in the bomb bay, and from the engine mounting pickups on the front spar, and also we had to lift from the rear fuselage. The rear fuselage was in very, very poor condition because it had been damaged in the forced landing. So we had to actually insert a beam through that and support that from the rear end through a trapeze at the top. It wasn't the best way to, it was worrying, but it was the only chance that we really had. Now, luckily, the weather cleared within the last week that we had. And again, you might remember this, it was on the television. The first attempt at lifting it took place on Sunday, June the 2nd, 2013. The forecast was good. We went out from Ramsgate Harbour in the afternoon, set the barge across over the wreck, popped down and we attached the lifting frame to the aeroplane. We were going to lift it at about 8 o'clock, but then at about 7 o'clock, the conditions changed really badly. Wave swell and height just got beyond limits and we just couldn't do it. The lifting frame was literally swinging around in the wind, so we had to take it back in again. We were about 45 minutes away from success, but we had to abandon it because it was just too dangerous. So we went back to Ramsgate feeling rather dejected and quite low in morale because by now funds were exhausted. But luckily, thanks to a generous donation by the RAF Museums American Foundation, plus some more money from EADS, we were able to go back for a second attempt. The forecast for the afternoon of Monday, June the 10th, gave the most realistic opportunity. So that day dawned bright, clear and calm. It was the best day we'd ever had. We left Ramsgate 10 o'clock in the morning, went out to the site, and then I thought, someone's doing this on purpose to me. We got to the wreck site, and we had to anchor the barge with 4-point cables, one at each end of the barge. One of the cables got entangled around the propeller of the lifting barge as it was being put down on the seabed. So that was what we didn't want. It took the divers about 4 hours to free it off, which left us with a 4 o'clock window only with half an hour to lift the aeroplane off the seabed. So we had to go for it, basically. You can see here the frame is being lowered to the seabed, and Dave Bridger, who worked for SeaTech, was incredibly good. He attached it to the airframe, and we began to lift. And these photographs were taken by the master of the GPS Apollo platform. You can see the Dornier lifting to the surface. It was the longest 5 minutes of my life, or 10 minutes of my life, but it was it came up remarkably well, actually. We did a lift in about 40 minutes. These were taken on board the Boxer Dunbar just after we'd done we'd dropped it. As it was being suspended above the Dunbarge to bring it back in, it was obviously creaking and groaning, and we were really urging them to get it down quickly because we were concerned if it did collapse, and that would have been on YouTube all over the world within about 10 minutes. But clearly we were okay there. First thing we did was walk around and inspect it to make sure there was actually no ordnance on board still and everything was fine, which it appeared to be. Great photograph of it on board the deck. Again, bashed and battered, but it's definitely a Dornier 17. So on the following day, June the 11th, the Dornier sailed into Ramsgate aboard the Boxer barge. It's quite strange to think that this plane probably flew over this area about 73 years before. Crowds were lining the quayside, all very anxious to see this warrior from a Gibbon age. And then we began the period of dismantling it. Once the concretions had been chipped away, we were surprised to discover that much of the internal structure and many of the fittings were in really good condition. The Norwegians had told us that we'd be able to undo nuts and bolts, as we mentioned earlier on. Incredibly, we were unable to do 6 of the main wing to fuselage retaining bolts. We could dismantle them without any issues at all, as you can see them here, which was quite remarkable. We then had to take the fuselage off the wing, which is a remarkably fragile and challenging operation, but we managed to do that successfully. And you can see the modular frame being used again for transport. It broke down into various sections. This is loading the fuselage at Ramsgate, ready to come back on June the 14th. And again with the wing. It left Cosford that afternoon and arrived the following day. We got tremendous coverage from the press. You probably remember at the time, this is an example of some of the newspapers that covered the event. So the conservation operation, we estimated it would take about a year, and that proved to be right, in fact. You can see the wing here in the hydration tunnels during the spraying process. It was the height of summer, so you can imagine the stench was really quite bad, especially for the offices that were just downwind of the aircraft site. But we had constant issues with the filters for the hydration tunnels getting blocked with marine life or what have you. But after about 6 months, we managed to get most of it off. It was remarkably good. You can see here, that's the starboard main wheel. And bullet holes in the starboard propeller. We found lots of evidence of the work. After first stage of cleaning, that's the fuselage wheeled outside. As I say, that was all about 6 years ago. Since then, museum's been very busy with the RAF Centenary program and development projects. But the aircraft now is in a stable condition, and it's contained within a conservation centre at Cosford. It's going to require a bespoke facility to actually display it, where we can keep the temperature and humidity at constant settings. And plans are to try and fit that into our developments for our Cosford site, but it won't be for the next couple of years. These were taken fairly recently, and they show you the fuselage in the conservation centre. Yeah, okay, it's full of holes, but the structure has remained very stable. I mean, it's 7 years ago, it was recovered now, and it still is very, very good. We thought about some exhibition ideas. Nothing has clearly been established yet. This was the first idea, to place it within the old Battle of Britain Hall here, but we don't wish to do that. We want to do it at Cosford now, because it's so fragile, we couldn't really bring it down to the Hendon site. And also, we'd like to showcase the conservation work we do at Cosford, because some of it really is groundbreaking. To try and help us with the interpretation, the Dornier had very distinctive, as you know, beetle eye, nose, and cockpit glass sections. We'd try and recreate some of those to give that impression. They'd obviously be wooden replicas. And that's pretty much it. So, thank you.